You write that the U.S. has a 30% chance of devolving into a civil war within the next 10 years. What would cause that to happen, and who would be responsible for that?
Well, let me clarify what I mean. What I mean is that fighting over the rules, it doesn't mean necessarily shooting each other, although you could see much more violence. It means that the rules of the system, that democracy by rule of law and the deferring to what the rules are, for example, to settle elections or settle issues, I think that that could be largely lost. I think, for example, like they had sanctuary cities, you could see situations in which the federal government would give mandates that would not be followed by the state governments. And then there's a question of how you just have power and who has what power. And I think that you're going to see a lot more tested through the legal system and then maybe even beyond, that they won't accept those rules. And then that's a threat to our democracy, because the great thing of our democracy is that they're following the rules, believing in it. I mean, we've seen repeatedly where a presidential candidate might have the majority, but they said there's electoral votes, and it comes down to that, and then they would say, well, for the greater good, we will agree on how that works. That's a remarkable following of the rules that our system's dependent on. And I think that almost anybody looking at the situation would say that there is some significant probability that might not work as well.
You talk about wealth inequality as an attribute of declining empires, but you contrast the U.S. with a rising China, which also has a very large disparity between rich and poor. Why is wealth inequality concerning in the case of the U.S., but less so when it comes to China?
Well, it has nothing to do with China or the U.S. It has to do with the nature of the phenomenon that you see across countries. It's not, if you have a large wealth gap or opportunity gap, and you have rising living standards, you don't have the same kind of conflict risks. It's the three, when the three work together, when you have a financial problem, and so you can't resolve that easily, and then you have the conflicts, and they can be over wealth, that's the left-right conflict, but there are other conflicts that end up, it could be, we see it about groups, that people tend to gather in groups. It could be ethnic, it could be whatever. And so you see that when you have that and you have challenges, other challenges like the rising power challenging another, there's more tension. And if you start to have lower living standards from that and a sense of inequity, it produces more conflict. That's happened repeatedly. That mix has happened repeatedly.
Let's go to the third trend that you write about in your book, which is the external threats, which in the case of the United States, you see mostly as a rising China. You say China is on its way to overtake the U.S. as the world's most powerful country. I guess the question is, why, and is that inevitable?
Well, the population of China is four times that of the United States. So if it has an average income of half the United States, it will be twice as large as the United States. When I first started to go to China in 1984, since then, its income has in real income has increased by 26 times. So if you just extrapolate lines and you look at productivity and the like, it's a very likelihood that China will be, it's today a comparable power in many ways, and that it would become a greater power. That's just how things are transpiring. And if you look at history, China has a history of being, prior to 1800, always, you know, like number one or two, because it has a large population and it's been very productive historically.
Bridgewater invests in China, as do many other funds and companies that do business with that country. But you and others have drawn criticism for, I guess, profiting off the rise of a country challenging the United States and at the same time acknowledging human rights violations committed by China. How do you respond to that, Ray?
Well, every company, every investor has to balance the interests of various parties. So for example, I have a responsibility to the investors. And then if there's not connections in its ways, companies, if they were separated, all these companies dealing together, if there was a separation, that means that it would not be efficient for the whole system. And so what we're looking at is guidance really by governments who understand all the issues, geopolitical issues and the like, to try to balance those issues and the constituencies and so on. So that's really our expertise is in investing and is in economics. And we think that as we will assess what percentage of the portfolio should be there. And we do that in 40 countries. When we think we invest in Brazil and many, many countries, and we have to rely really on the guidance of not only our country, but the countries that are there, because it's not just a matter of what we individually think. It's a matter of making the right decisions based on the people who are in the responsibility of assessing them, make those decisions.
You know, things have changed so much over just say the past 10, 5 years. I mean, it used to be yourself, people like you and John Mack, Hank Paulson could be described as friendly to China. And now, you know, that description gets more difficult. You've got Mitt Romney calling you out, you know, Fox hosts calling you a collaborator. Does it trouble you that this has changed so much, our relationship and how people view the relationship and how you are a part of that relationship, Ray?
I could deal with me. What does trouble me is that both sides really don't know each other well. And it strikes me as a very inclination to be emotional and to fight. And that raises the odds of a fight on both sides. And it's almost a needless fight. I mean, there are things that you have to say, what will you fight for? And what are the consequences of that fight? So I believe in peace. I mean, that doesn't mean you shan't, when your essential values yourself are threatened by an outsider, I think you have to fight for that. But the inclination to immediately stereotype and fight rather than to try to seek what are the other side's perspectives, and that demonization is a dangerous thing that could bring about a war, and a needless war.
How should we, though, Ray, respond, we being the United States, respond to the rise of China, either positively, negatively, carrots, sticks? What should we do?
I think that there are five types of wars. The first four are competitions, really. There's a trade war, a technology war, a geopolitical influence war, and a capital war. Those can be viewed as competitions. And then there's a military war. In all of those cases, the most important thing that you can do is be strong. Us, internally, if we do the right things to be strong, so that we are stronger than any opposition in the world, we won't have a problem. So I think the biggest war that we're having is a war with ourselves to be able to be productive, to earn more money than we spend, to improve our income statement and our balance sheet, and to be good with each other so that we're productive together rather than at each other's throats and threatening our effectiveness.
You say a military confrontation between the U.S. and China is unlikely for now, but becomes increasingly possible as China catches up. What are some signs that we should see perhaps that would concern us?
Well, I think if there's going to be a military war issue, it is likely to be around Taiwan. I think other issues are not military triggering. And just the view of that is Chinese perspective and American perspective both, and the world has said there's one China, Taiwan support of China, and they should have peaceful unification. That issue is a diplomatically worded issue, but it's an important issue that might be, could be fought over. I think that you watch it. You watch the news, you keep on top of that, and you see the actions. So beyond that, I think it's mostly the competitions in those other areas. And I think it's just be strong, but watch what's going on closely with Taiwan. That you'll see the straws in the wind.
Taking a step back, Ray, and looking at the big picture here, you know, it sort of suggests, at least my take on the book is that, wow, you're writing about, and you're saying empires in decline, you're writing about the U.S. in decline. Is that the case? And is it inevitable? How bad could it get? How can we turn it around and have it not happen?
I express very little opinions in the book. I do express opinions, but what I thought was very important was to have objective measurements. So you see 18 different gauges that include a variety of measures of relative strength. Measures such as education, productivity, building of infrastructure, how many inventions come out of the country, many different measures of performance. So those objective performance measures are the most important thing I could get across. So anybody can watch those. They're like a health index. You can see if the levels are going improving or deteriorating, whether the income and balance sheet thing is improving, any of those. So it was most important to me not to be ideological or opinionated. I don't think my opinions matter as much as the reasoning behind that. And that's why I put those in and also created a model that has a cause-effect relationship. I looked at 10-year leading indicators of output. In other words, everything that happens has causes that make it happen. And by being able to measure those cause-effect relationships and putting them into graphic and numerical form, and then using those to then give an indicator, I could show what happened, and that's what my objective was. So the reader of the book will be able to make their own judgments. What you see in the book are really those measures over time, repeatedly through the rises and declines of empires.